Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program designed to present you with facts, figures, and interpretations of the week's events in economics, the jobs, the incomes, the debts, all of those dimensions of our lives. My name is Richard Wolff. I'm a professor of economics at the New School in New York City, and I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. I now work to produce these radio programs as well as a host of other things that I'll have more to say about later in the program. But let's jump right in with some of this last week's events. The first one is a perennial now, has been so for months, and that's the crisis in and around Greece. Much of that is political theater on both sides, the Syriza government in Greece and the Europeans on the other side. Other than that, the situation is quite different. The European Central Bank, the European Union, the Germans in particular, as the dominant economy there, have been pressing very hard for the Greeks to continue with the austerity program that has hobbled that society and that economy and has not brought the promised benefits, not even a little. And on the other hand, the Syriza government coming to power in January of this year, promising to end the crippling austerity imposed by what was another part of what was supposed to be a unified Europe. In the last week, with more and more tensions, everybody is feeding the rumor mill on both sides. It's a little hard to follow, and my advice to most folks would be not to bother until something firm is finally agreed to, which could be at any moment. I do want to take up two points raised by the Europeans to make it look as though there's something justified in imposing horrific cutbacks that already in Greece have crippled their medical system, their school system, cut jobs by thousands, perhaps millions, certainly cut incomes by 30% to 40% for most public employees and many private ones, a cutback unlike anything so far imposed elsewhere in the developed world. It seems as if Greece is being singled out, and I'll have more to say about that in a moment. Here are the two arguments that are coming out of the Europeans seeking, if lamely, to justify things. First, they demand that there is labor reform. They portray the working class in Greece as somehow lazy and inefficient, and the usual kinds of insults. There's no evidence that Greek workers do much less than any other workers, a good bit of evidence to suggest that they are less well paid than other Europeans and work as hard or harder. But there's not much to say. It's a vague argument. The second argument is more precise. It argues that Greeks are privileged in the absurdly large pensions they get, the age at which they retire, things like that. So I looked into that because I wanted to see whether there was anything more in substance to that argument than any of the others that the Europeans have put forward. And I can't claim I'm surprised. I discovered there wasn't. So let's briefly go through it. The statistic Europeans like to point to is the percentage of the GDP, of the gross output in Greece, that goes to pay pensions. And that, they said, correctly, by the way, is larger in Greece, 17% roughly, than it is elsewhere in Europe. So the Greeks spend more relative to their total economy on pensions than other Europeans do. But anyone with even a little bit of education in economics knows that that number, in order to be understood, has to be probed a little bit. And the most obvious probe is to raise the possibility that in Greece there may be a larger percentage of people in the pension age than in other European countries. And if that's true, then the fact that they're spending more on pensions doesn't show that they are being profligate with their pensions. It simply shows that they have a larger percentage of their people that are over 60 or 65 years of age. And sure enough, when that statistic is looked at, here's what we found. If you look at people over 65, which is the general cutoff age one uses for these comparisons, Countries vary a little bit. The Germans have 1 year, which is the normal retirement age. The Greeks have another. The United States has another. But it's all in the early mid-60s age range. Anyway, if you look at the pension per person over 65, a very widely used statistic, here's what you discover. That pensions for people over 65 in Greece are below the European average. In other words, because Greece has more people of pension age than other countries, they take a larger share of their total economy. But when you look at what it means per person who gets a pension, he or she in Greece gets less of a pension in euros than do other Europeans. So the Greeks are not in some bizarre class by themselves, doing well with pensions that other Europeans don't get. Nothing of the sort. Indeed, in a comparison done of elderly folks at risk of poverty in 2013, 15% of Greeks were at risk of poverty, as compared to 13% as the average across Europe. Bottom line, the economic crisis of capitalism that hit in 2008 devastated many economies. That led the governments of those economies to come in and fix the problem by helping those at the top, big bankers, big corporations, stock markets. Those have indeed recovered in many parts of the world, the United States and Europe. What was not helped were the people, the average people across the society, the middle and lower incomes. That's why it is both unethical and immoral to be imposing on the middle and lower classes an austerity to pay for the cost of the government support of those at the top who are arguably the ones most responsible for bringing the crisis. Selecting Greece as the whipping boy, the place to see how far you can push the working class, is what's going on. And the arguments are purely excuses. What's most interesting is that the Greeks have fought back, elected a government pledged not to continue the austerity, fighting like crazy against an almost unified Europe pressing down on them. But here's the irony of ironies. It's the Europeans, not the Greeks, that are in the weak position here. The whole of European politics has been premised for the last 20, 30 years on a unified Europe, a kind of United States of Europe, to confront in a unified way the United States of America and the colossus that China has become. In order for that unity to function, you cannot treat one part of yourself, one part of Europe, Greece, as if it were some pariah imposing on them levels of suffering way out of proportion to everybody else. It's a little bit as though the United States went through the current crisis, bailed out the big banks, and now really whacked the people of Rhode Island as some kind of way of paying for all of this. We would all think this was bizarre. That's what the Europeans are doing. And since they haven't achieved their unity, they are teaching many others to wonder about whether being part of Europe is worth it, given the kind of horrible, unbalanced, over-the-top punishment meted out to one small country, Greece, 2% of the European economy, if that, having no responsibility for the crisis, but being made to bear the brunt of punishing austerity to cope with the costs of bailing out those at the top. The next few weeks will show, because the Greeks are running out of money, what kind of a deal the Europeans will have to make to hold on to Greece, since literally pushing Greece out to withdraw from the European Union, to go back to the drachma or another currency instead of the euro, will be to deal a major blow to any chance of a European Union. And that's, after all, what even the major capitalists of Europe have been pushing for decades. The next update I want to talk about is important. It has to do with a comment made in the last 10 days by Warren Buffett. And his comment is extraordinary, and I want to read it to you so there's no misunderstanding. I believe it was made literally on the 21st of May. I'm quoting now Warren Buffett. "No conspiracy lies behind this depressing fact. The poor are most definitely not poor because the rich are rich. Nor are the rich undeserving. Most of them have contributed brilliant innovations or managerial expertise to America's well-being." Wow. Let's talk about that. And let's talk about it on several levels. First of all, if we're really going to go down that road, Mr. Buffett, then the only people who ought to become rich are those who actually made a contribution, not the fact that they were the children of somebody who made a contribution. Many of the richest people, let me simply pick the Walton family. The man who created Walmart, Sam Walton, is dead. And the people who own the $80 to $100 billion of wealth in that corporation are his descendants. They didn't contribute anything brilliant or nothing like what he did in your calculus. So you would have to say something about all the people whose wild wealth has nothing to do with a contribution they made. Shall we list all the Rockefellers, Mr. Buffett? Shall we list all the Carnegies and all the rest? Number two, even if we had an inheritance tax that prevented these people from passing wild wealth onto their children, which we don't, but even if we did, it would still be possible for these people to take wild amounts of wealth and do what they like with it before they died, putting them in the position of deciding where enormous amounts of wealth are going to be used in society. We, the people as a whole, have to live with how that money gets spent. How is it squareable with democracy that a few people can decide how to spend vast amounts of money? We'd have to live with the results, but have no say over how that money gets spent. You didn't address that question, did you, Mr. Buffett? Third, let's look at what these brilliant innovations are. He mentioned Henry Ford, by the way. He mentioned all kinds of well-known people in American history. I'm a professor. Here's what I know about people who make breakthroughs. Those people were usually trained by other people, their parents, their relatives, their teachers, their friends, countless books that they read, programs they watched, films that they saw, people along the way that they interacted with. Their understanding came at the end of a long chain of discovery, of investigation. It is a bizarre quality of our society that instead of rewarding, if that's what you want to do, all of the people whose work over time accumulates into the insight that one particular individual who happens to come towards the end of this process rather than earlier, why we reward one enormously and ignore all the others is nothing to be proud of and nothing to use as a defense. All the people who gave Henry Ford whatever brains he had, whatever insight he had, where are they in the reward structure? Nowhere. That misunderstands what breakthroughs are. They come at the end of a long, complicated process. We ought to congratulate and reward the schools the innovator went to, the people who trained him, the co-workers who gave him understanding, etc., etc. And now the biggest one of all. If we want to reward people who make breakthroughs, understanding that they're really part of a process that involves many people and not the lonely hero of our fantasy, then give them $1 million. It's a lot. Mr. Buffett has $71 billion. He has more money than many countries dispose of in a year. That's not necessary, that's not appropriate, and that's not fair to all the other people in this society. He decides what to do with it. In a minute, I'm going to give you an example of another rich billionaire and what he did to drive the point home. But in order to give an incentive, we can be very modest. We can give you a plaque somewhere. We can give you an hour on television with national recognition, and we can give you $1 million. But to give you 70 billion or numbers like that is obscene and fundamentally undemocratic. Case in point. This last week, Harvard University proudly announced a statement by Drew Faust, the president at Harvard, proudly announced the largest corporate gift, well, actually largest personal gift that Harvard has ever gotten. $400 million by the hedge fund manager John A. Paulson, P-A-U-L-S-O-N. He gave $400 million to Harvard. He is a billionaire. So is Harvard. Harvard is the richest university in terms of its wealth in the United States. It disposes of 36 plus billions of dollars in its portfolio of stocks, bonds, real estate, and so on. Therefore, it is the university that least needs financial help of any university in the United States. It could have spent the $400 million Mr. Paulson gave it out of its own 36 plus billions and hardly noticed the transaction. The money is going to go to develop its School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. That will be renamed the John A. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and the dean will be called the John A. Paulson Dean. So Mr. Paulson gets his name all over the building and all over the administration of the building. How nice for him. What could $400 million do? It could transform schools and universities across this country, those that don't get the kinds of contributions Harvard gets and need it 10 times more. This is obscene. This is a billionaire making another billionaire institution even richer than it was before. This is not a way to allocate scarce resources. And at a time when universities around the country are sticking their students with higher tuition costs, imposing horrific debt burdens on them, you don't think we could have found a better use for $400 million, but if we leave the disposition of these obscene amounts of wealth gathered into the hands of a tiny number of people, if we leave the distribution of our wealth in their hands, this is what we get. The richest university in the country got richer still, and everybody else can watch. Wow. All I can say is wow. Finally, I want to bring to your attention, as I sometimes do, an academic paper that makes an important point. Here's the point. Tax cuts do not bring jobs. Wow. Further, if you want to help jobs and you want to use tax cuts, the best tax cuts in terms of job creation are those who favor lower income groups. The effect of tax cuts for the top 10% on employment growth is small. Wow. There it is. Do you want to create jobs? Give tax cuts to middle and lower income people. The bulk of tax cuts in the last 25 years in this country have gone to those at the top. The rationalization has been it's job creation. The research shows no, it isn't. So let me tell you what the paper is, and you can go get it and read it for yourself. The author, Owen Zidar, Z-I-D-A-R. The paper was produced for the National Bureau of Economic Research, a conservative economic think tank. It's their working paper number 21035. 21035. It was issued in March of 2015. The author again, Owen Zidar, Z-I-D-A-R, and the paper is called Tax Cuts for Whom? Let me turn now, as we do at this part of the program, to responding to questions that you have sent in. The first one has to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and indeed deals like that that the government of the United States is working out both with Pacific countries and with Europe in terms of an Atlantic partnership, and they are both important. These are efforts of corporations in these parts of the world to free themselves from government controls. They want the governments to agree that the government cannot interfere in all kinds of plans and programs and policies and procedures that these corporations undertake. Now, we know corporations do what they do to make profit. They don't hide that. To tell the world that they need to be free of government is saying to be free of any way that the people of the world can limit their profit-driven activities in terms of the damage they do to working people, to the environment, to economic systems as a whole. These kinds of partnerships are efforts of corporations to give themselves more freedom by reducing ours, and we should fight them, whether they be TPP in the Pacific or the transatlantic partnerships. These are not appropriate institutions, and when they deprive people of the right to use politics to control the economy, this is not good for the mass of the people, as the NAFTA disaster has shown us already. Finally, one of you asked a question about the elections in Spain, and in particular, the victory of two women who are about to become mayors of the two largest cities in Spain, Madrid and Barcelona. The one in Madrid still needs some political negotiations, so it's not 100% settled, but the one in Barcelona is. Ada Colau, I hope I'm pronouncing that reasonably well, will be the new mayor of Barcelona. She's a woman activist, mother of a four-year-old boy, and here's what she is. And the reason I'm telling you this story is not just to answer the question, but to talk about economics and its role in politics, and also to make a comment about the Occupy movement, which, by the way, was important in Spain, just as it was in the United States and indeed many other countries. But its development in the United States was to fade a little bit from the picture. It's still here, but not what it was in the autumn of 2011. But that's not been the case in other countries, Spain, for example. So in Spain, the Occupy movement became better known as the movement of the indignados, those who were indignant about what had happened. Spain's crisis was particularly a crisis of housing, of the housing built by millions of Spaniards with borrowing that they could not sustain. The housing market collapsed in Spain, as it did in the United States, but it produced a very powerful movement in Spain that has lasted and grown, unlike the United States. Out of the indignados emerged the movement called Podemos, We Can, and one of its leaders, Ada Colau. Her particular movement was the following. She was outraged politically when it was discovered that across Spain, banks told the folks who could not sustain their mortgages, okay, if you can't make your mortgage payment, we're going to throw you out of your home and we're going to take your home back as your punishment for failing to maintain your mortgage payments. This, the people suffered. But then the banks wanted to continue collecting on the loans they made to those people even after they had thrown them out of their homes and taken the homes away from them so that they would still be left with a debt. This, Ada Colau thought, was outrageous and unfair, and she developed, together with others, a movement to insist that banks cancel mortgage debts after they repossessed the homes. On that basis, she became well known. She stood for election to the mayor of Barcelona, the second biggest city, and she was decisively victorious in the election a few weeks ago. What an amazing story of a movement built around an economic crisis, refusing to allow that crisis to be rectified on the backs of the mass of people, building a political movement around that, running for office, and winning, and becoming now a very important political player, not just in Barcelona, where she will be the mayor, but across Spain. And Spain is Europe's fourth largest economy. This has been noticed everywhere, London, Paris, Berlin. This is a sign that what has happened to Greece with the arising of the Syriza movement, committed to a whole new politics, not built around bailing out the richest, that this has spread to Spain in a powerful way. All right, folks, we have come, for better or worse, to the end of the first half of this program. Please stay with us. We have a very exciting next half. I was privileged to be able to meet with Keshama Sawant, the person, the young woman, elected to the City Council of Seattle in 2013. She's running for re-election this fall. She's the first socialist to be elected in recent memory to such a high office. 94,000 people voted her in. She is a woman of color, as well as a self-proclaimed socialist. A remarkable thing. Please also remember to look and use our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Sign up for our newsletter. And in other ways, please make use of all the work we do on those websites as well as on this program. And stay with us. We'll be right back.
She was 16 and 6 feet tall in a crowd of teenagers coming out of the zoo. She stumbled, started slipping, falling, teeter-tottered on the double patent leather shoes. I happened to catch her and said, maybe these ruby shoes are a little cumbersome for you. Maybe for you.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update for this week. I'm very proud to announce that this next half of the program, the second half, will be devoted to a recorded interview I did at the Left Forum in New York City, May 28th, with Keshama Sawant, the elected member of the City Council in Seattle, Washington, who shook up the awareness of Americans when, as a self-proclaimed socialist, she was swept into office in the autumn of 2013. So please stay with me now for that interview. Well, I'm glad to be here this evening with Keshama Sawant from Seattle, Washington. You've become a famous person for many of us here in the United States, a socialist who ran for city council back in 2013 and won, and has been on the council and will be up for re-election in the fall. You know, we can start this way in our conversation. Not too long ago, it was unthinkable that a woman would run for a significant office in the United States and win. It was unthinkable that anyone who wasn't white would do the same. And over the last two or three decades, we've seen that women have entered the political arena and done just fine. We may even see one in the White House. And we already see that a person could be in the White House who isn't white. But one taboo has not yet been broken, or at least hadn't been. Very rarely in the last half century have people who call themselves socialists
put up their names and run for office. And while that was rare, having them win the election, that was rarer still. So let's start with this remarkable reality. Tell us why you chose to be upfront and clear with the people of Seattle that you were a socialist. What did it mean in your mind, and what do you think it meant in theirs?
Well, thank you, Rick, first of all, for having me here. And to start with what you mentioned, you know, that the struggles of women, people of color, the LGBTQ, in finding their place, rightful place in society has been real. But without minimizing that struggle, and you know, a struggle that's still ongoing, I think it's important to point out that while the fact that we had an African-American enter the White House, the fact that we have a leading contender who's a woman for next year's presidential elections does reflect a certain progress that has been made for women and people of color. It's important to recognize that they themselves, you know, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, have not been the upholders of the struggles of working people everywhere, including majority people of color. And so I think what stands out about me should not be, I hope people are not taking away the message that it's an immigrant woman of color. My point is that it what stood out was that a socialist, an open socialist, won the election. And as you said, that's the most important thing. And to me, socialism means a way to organize human society such that every human being is able to attain a high standard of living in an environmentally sustainable way. And when you put it that way, I haven't met a single ordinary working person. I mean, I haven't talked to the billionaires and what they think about it, and I can guess what they might. But for ordinary working people who are engaged in a day-to-day battle for survival, that sounds like a very appealing prospect. And so it completely takes away from the vilification and the demonizing of the idea of socialism that happened in the Cold War era. But I think a very important point for us to take away from what's happened with our election, with the Occupy movement, with the Black Lives Matter movement, all of that, is that we are now in a completely different era. And the younger generations, the ones who are now radicalizing and politicizing for the first time, they didn't grow up under the shadow of the Cold War. So they don't come out into the political arena with having some sort of preconceived notions about socialism. What they are coming out with is a deep sense of betrayal from the existing system, from capitalism. That's what's striking. You know, people talk about the S word. I would say, let's talk about the C word and how people are completely disgusted and unhappy with the way politics is run in the interests of the billionaires, not in the interests of the working people. And I think that's what grabbed people's attention in our campaign, that we stood out for working people.
I want to drive that point home for those watching and listening. If I understand correctly, in the election that you won back in 2013, you had something on the order of 180,000 people voting in that election. How many of those votes did you get?
We got nearly 94,000 votes.
Okay, I think for American history, right here we should stop and take a breath. 94,000 people in the city of Seattle, Washington, in the year 2013, voted for a socialist candidate and thereby brought her into the city council, a chamber of 9 persons, if I understand correctly, and that you now sit there with a vote that helps determine the future of that situation. This is a historical event, and I think many of the people watching this program or listening to this program will take away that as something really to stop and think about. Tell us a little bit before we go on, what's your situation this year, when I understand you come up for another election to see whether you'll be reelected and so on? What is it shaping up like for you?
Right. Just to start with what you said, you're absolutely right, Rick. Our election as an openly socialist candidate in a major metropolitan area of the United States, this is the belly of the capitalist beast, this is absolutely historic. And what happened after that has also been a continuation of that historic process, winning the fight for $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle. That would not have happened had we not had this victory. And so all of that is showing, I think more than anything else, the fact that the vast majority of American people, especially young people, this is not unique to Seattle, are sick and tired of corporate politics as usual. business as usual politics and are looking for something different. They're looking for organizational structures and leadership that boldly and unambiguously fight for the interests of working people and not for the interests of Wall Street. That is what people are disgusted by. You know, the fact that both the Democratic and Republican Party establishments are basically loyal to Wall Street. That's the interest that they're representing, regardless of the lip service they provide occasionally to the interests of the rest of us. And so this year, I'm up for re-election. We are seeing played out in Seattle something that we always knew was going to happen, which is that the ruling class of Seattle, which is, who are they? The Chamber of Commerce, the big developers, big corporations like Vulcan, which is a big real estate monster that was created by, among others, Paul Allen, one of the Microsoft billionaires, and all of the big real estate corporations, the big restaurant association and so on. All of these forces, the forces of big business, are arrayed systematically against us because they know just as well as we should what's at stake. You know, when we won in 2013, to some degree, we were able to win because the establishment never thought we would amount to anything, because such a thing hasn't happened in decades. You know, this socialist underdog winning against a 16-year incumbent, that was unthinkable to them. But now they've seen not only what socialist alternative, you know, what we are capable of, but much more important than that, they've seen that there is a deep hunger among ordinary working people for a political shift, and that they are responding with that need for a political shift to us. And they've seen what we've been able to do, which is not just one city council member, you know, taking some sort of morally pure steps on the city council. No, what they're seeing is the use of the voice in City Hall through me being there to build social movements in Seattle, to empower ordinary people to take control of politics. That is what threatens big business and the establishment. And so this year, we will see them going into a systematic attack against us. There will be television attacks, there will be personal attacks against me. We've already seen, documented through a newspaper article recently, that there will be outside money pouring in. So I would appeal to everybody who's watching this, if you're inspired by what we've done, you need to get involved and help us win the re-election, because there's a lot at stake for us as well.
You know, people who've been involved in politics know that to get 94,000 votes to win in an urban area, you have to have an organization. You have to have gotten together a sizable number of people with an extraordinary commitment, and to win again and to have a sustaining movement without which an election comes and goes requires a focus on organization. Tell us what kinds of organization you had built, and tell us how you are continuing to build an organization as, in the end, the basis for what you're trying to do.
I'm so glad you're asking. This is one of the most important questions that we need to spend time on. And I think at the outset, I should say that one very fundamental difference in our campaign than most of what people see as politics or what most people see as politicians is that this campaign was not launched in the service of one individual's political and personal career. You know, it's not like I woke up one morning and said, I'm going to run and I'm going to have some personal glory out of this. What we did was, in Socialist Alternative, which is a nationwide organization of social and economic justice activists, we, coming out of the Occupy movement, realized, like some others did, that there was a huge opening for the left. There's a vacuum. There's a political vacuum. You know, there's a Democratic Party establishment and the Republican Party establishment are out here, that is, you know, on their own planet, completely out of touch with the needs of the vast majority of people. And there's this vacuum where most others exist, where the people are looking for something different. And so we decided that the best way of showing to the left nationally that there is this vacuum and we better fill it before the right fills it was to run an actual campaign. So we ran it at the city council level, and everything that we've seen happening through the campaign and after the victory has proven us right, has proven that the left has an extraordinary opportunity, a historic opportunity to really build itself, not just in Seattle, but nationally. So I think that one of the takeaway messages from our campaign is that, first of all, there has to be an organizational structure which includes a multitude of people, a collective of voices that is able to democratically decide we should run in this election and this should be our candidate, and this is how we're going to run our campaign platform. So development of every step of that campaign has to be a truly democratic process, you know. So when we developed our campaign, it was a product of democratic engagement by everybody in Socialist Alternative that, you know, we're going to call for a fight for 15. We're going to call for taxing the wealthy to fund mass transit and education. We're going to call for various other measures like rent control. All of this was a product of, you know, democratic engagement. And then when we launched our campaign, its success was absolutely determined by how much we were able to engage the broader public. And so by the end of our campaign, we had more than 400 volunteers, dedicated volunteers, really, you know, plastering the entire city with our red posters. I mean, again, such a thing hasn't been seen in decades. And so we really tapped into this grassroots potential. And I do believe that going forward, the most important question to grapple for the U.S. left is how are we going to get back in touch with those tens of millions of people who are looking for an urgent shift in politics. And one of the things you mentioned, which is very crucial, is connecting electoral campaigns to ongoing social movements. We have to absolutely be rooted in social movements. Otherwise, not only will we not get any success, it will not create any meaningful change. You know, meaningful change cannot come from one electoral campaign. That can be a building block, but there's a lot more to do. That is why we thought it was very important for us to be rooted within social movements, and that is why we've been, and I personally have been, an integral part of Occupy. Through my union, teachers union, I've been an integral part of the fight against budget cuts and student debt. We were an essential part of the fight for 15 in Seattle, along with the labor movement, along with other organizations. And we are now really, we believe that the Black Lives Matter movement is also necessary. We have to really integrate these movements and make them strong.
Well, let me pick up on one of those things. You mentioned the labor movement. If I understand correctly, you had a relatively small number of locals in that area support you back in 2013, but that a much larger number of union locals are supporting you for re-election in the coming autumn election. Could you tell us both why there were relatively few to begin with and why there are many more now? Have you become, in effect, labor's candidate, or is that an exaggeration?
I don't think, first of all, it would be an exaggeration at all to say that I'm Labour's candidate. I am definitely Labour's candidate, both in terms of the official support that we now have. We have more than 30 different locals supporting us openly and donating to our campaign. We also have the King County Labour Council, the local AFL-CIO, that has just voted, the delegates just voted to endorse our campaign. But also, I'm a Labour candidate because I am very unambiguously and boldly declaring my loyalty to workers, to the labor movement. I mean, it's not, you know, one of the points I make often is that you have Democratic Party establishment candidates, you know, that's who we have on the Seattle City Council. It's not that they are not complete, it's not that they are completely out of touch with labor. What's true is that while they take money from labor, they also take money from the Chamber of Commerce. They take money from the big developers, from the big real estate, for their campaigns. So the point is, though, that even though they're getting money from both sides, who wins? At the end of the day, if you look at the policy outcomes, you know, in a city like Seattle, which is by no means unique in its social and economic outcomes, there's a deep wealth and income inequality. Housing is unaffordable to the vast majority of workers now. You know, the city has become unaffordable and unlivable. At whose doorstep does this lie? This lies at the doorstep of the Democratic Party establishment, which for decades has got unquestioning support from the labor movement. And so our message, you know, shared message to everyone of our sisters and brothers in labor is that, look, we all for decades have tried this out. This strategy of pouring money into the Democratic Party and bringing out hundreds of thousands of foot soldiers for their campaign, you know, get out the vote, has failed for us. Because at the end of the day, the money that speaks louder is the money of Wall Street, is the money of big developers. And so whether you're talking about Seattle or at the national level, I think a fundamental step that needs to happen is the breaking of the labor movement from the Democratic Party establishment, and the labor movement using the tremendous resources that it has at its disposal, both financial and political, to put those resources squarely and fully to build a left alternative party for people in the United States.
But don't sell short, again, the history. It is very important for everyone watching and listening to understand that your victory as a self-proclaimed socialist has enabled, despite that, despite all the years of demonization of everything having to do with socialism, has led the labor movement in that area to contribute money, to contribute its official endorsement to a socialist candidate. It does suggest, as it ought to, for people in many other parts of the United States, what is in fact possible that we might think about. And if the labor movement, plus the organization you developed before your election, and that you now can use your position to help develop further, can come together in some way in coalition with the labor movement, we're talking about social forces in a position to change the United States. This is very, very important.
It's extremely important, actually, and I absolutely appreciate you stressing the fact that this, we've shown that it can be done the first time with minimal labor support, although I have to say at that time, a lot of the labor unions would privately tell me, you know, I absolutely agree with everything you stand for, but I'm afraid that if you don't win, then the Democratic Party will take revenge on us. And I think that's very telling, you know. This is the stranglehold, the political stranglehold that the establishment politicians have had labor movement and the rest of us in, you know, where we have to continue pouring money into their campaigns. At the same time, we are not supposed to demand anything. I mean, look at the whole charade with the TPP and Fast Track. The entire labor movement has been against it. But that does not stop Obama and the Democrats from having the temerity to go out to Nike to sell TPP as some sort of great thing for labor and the environment. I mean, this is the shamelessness with which the Democratic Party establishment engages on these issues. And that is why I think what's powerful about what we've shown is that we can win as an independent left alternative, having broken from the two-party establishment, and that we can get the labor movement to stand squarely with us, which they're doing this year. And I think this is such an inspiring message for the labor movement nationally, that we should be, this is what we should be doing. And it's important, critically important, that the labor movement is standing with us. This is going to be the one of the backbones of the fight against the ruling class, which is, you know, going into battle against us this year. But I think, you know, while this message is inspiring, and as it should be, we should also inject a sobering note into it. We've just seen the national AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, you know, declaring his unconditional support to Hillary Clinton's campaign. That should be pointed out as a problem. You know, we have gained nothing by supporting establishment candidates of the Democratic Party. We need the labor movement to chart a different course for the next several years to really bring out these historic, you know, breakthroughs that we've had in a much bigger way. Nationally, we need the labor movement to put its support into an independent left alternative.
Good. Let me ask you some questions that I know people are interested to know. Questions about who voted for you. You must have studied after the election was over to understand, and that's what I want to ask you about. Tell us a little bit about whether your voters were people who used to vote for the Democratic Party, but who broke from that and took this interesting historic step of voting for a socialist? Or were they new people who haven't voted for a while, but who found your candidacy a reason to participate when they didn't in the past? That's one question. At the same time, tell us a little bit about older versus younger voters, white versus non-white, male versus female. Give us a sense of who gathered in your camp to make this possible.
I think it was, in a way, you sort of answered the question, because it was all of that, and it really shows you how the wide spectrum of people who are completely unhappy and angry at the status of politics. So for the most part, yes, we absolutely needed the support of people who habitually vote and also habitually vote Democrat. And I think that's a very important point, because it shows you the degree to which the Democratic Party establishment is out of touch. It is out of sync with its rank and file activists and people who consider themselves Democratic Party voters. I mean, there was any number of people who came to me personally and said, you know, I've never voted for anybody other than a Democrat, but what you stand for, you know, really fighting for working people, you know, really having an undivided loyalty to the needs of working people and the poor, and having the courage to call out the corrupt politicians, having the courage to say that we need to tax the super wealthy and big corporations. People have been dying to hear this, and they've never heard this in decades. And all these people who talk to me, they are people who habitually vote Democratic Party and are looking for something different. But we also, in addition to that, had a lot of first-time voters, people who are completely disengaged from politics, people who feel disenfranchised, people who feel that neither party represents them, and finally saw something worth fighting for. So many of them not only voted, but they also got involved in the campaign in different ways, you know, still write to us saying, you know, is there something to be involved in, and so on. So I think it shows you how there is this big ocean of people who are completely disengaged from politics, and if the left provided a pole of attraction, that is what people are waiting for. And we need this to be seen not just in Seattle and not just in various local jurisdictions. We need this to break out on the national scene.
Tell me a little bit about the old, young, male, female, white, now. Just, I think you've made the key point that you got them all. But tell us a little bit about the composition, the different groups, why they came or didn't, etc.
Right. I mean, like I said, we wouldn't have won the election. I mean, 94,000 votes is a lot of votes to get, and that means that we appealed. Our campaign had a broad appeal, which is the most important. Like, it's an empowering message for the left. You know, we are not a fringe. Our message has broad appeal. But it's also important to stress, and I'm glad you asked, that a lot of young people who don't turn to electoral politics as a rule, as some sort of, you know, inspiring arena for political action, with good reason, they don't, but for the first time turned to our campaign, and many of them said, you know, I've never voted before, but I really want to vote this time. Many of them got their voter registration because they wanted to vote for our campaign. And I think it points towards the, you know, the need for us to reject a false dichotomy between electoral strategies and building movements. They have to go together, because the only way we will win social change is if we empower a mass of people to go and fight around political, concrete political demands, and that can't be done without mass movements. But those mass movements are going to inevitably be hamstrung, be paralyzed, unless we also take those movements and capture the political arena. That is why it's so critical that these electoral successes are recognized not as a one-off, but as a sign of things that can be possible.
And I think, therefore, in closing, because we are limited in time, let's go back to that one big question, at least in the minds of many of us. Do you think you can, before the reaction comes at you in an overwhelming way, build up the kind of organization? Because the left, you have shown us with your election, is very large. The left that can be reached by a leftist politician who calls herself a socialist is very large. That's fantastic news. The next question, though, immediately poses itself. Can you organize? Can you bring these people together in some level of ongoing organized activity so that they can spread, run more candidates, be an even stronger force for you, but also bring out in all the other people the other Shama Sawants that are out there waiting? Is this this organizational consciousness, is that growing? Is that something you focus on?
First of all, in terms of how I feel, whether it can be done or not, I'm completely optimistic. I mean, as you know, we can't be Marxists if we weren't also entirely optimistic of the potential for the human mind and for the human race. But I think in order to actually achieve those things, you know, tangibly, in reality, it's not an automatic, it's not a given. We will get it if we fight for it. So I think the main message for everybody to take from our conversation today is that if you want to see that happen, it's not going to happen unless you get involved, which means real things, meaning, first of all, this year, helping us, no matter where you are in the U.S., you have to help us win this re-election campaign. Because if we don't win this year, we have every chance of winning. But if we don't win, the establishment and the corporate media get to write the historic narrative that it was a flash in the pan, it can't be done, really. forget about it, folks. Leave the politics to the grown-ups. All you young rabble-rousers can go home. But imagine, on the flip side, imagine what a message it would send if we won the election in November. Oh, my God, it would be a transformative and even more historic than what we've done so far, because this victory this year will have been achieved in the face of the reaction, as you said, in the face of a concerted attack by big business to defeat me. And so I think if we are able to do that this year, which I absolutely think we can, but we need the help of everyone out there who consider themselves on the left everywhere in the country. But if we do that, we have a historic opportunity after November to make a serious call for a national left political alternative. Imagine the power of that conversation beginning when we have, again, another dog and pony show waiting for us next year with Hillary Clinton and a Republican. I think, you know, this is absolutely a brilliant moment for us to begin that conversation.
Shama Sawant, thank you very much for your time, for joining us, and I hope the inspiration of your victory in Seattle has been better communicated now across the country, and indeed, given how many people will see this, around the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our program. I hope you found the interview, as well as the rest of the program, of interest. Please remember to make use of our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis. Please check them out at truthout.org. You can sign up for our newsletter on the websites. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter by clicking on the icon. You can see where we'll be traveling. You can contact us with questions, comments, and if you'd like us to come and present something in your area of the country. Thank you for listening. I look forward to speaking with you again next week. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.